accession number 6287, reel 1.
Mr. Hood, reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Mr. Hood, a little bit about your family and educational background?
Yes, my father was a schoolmaster in a small Scottish village called Edsel, in what was then Angus and is now, I think, Campion. He was headmaster of a small four-teacher school. We then went on to live in Montrose, also in Angus, where he was headmaster of the junior school of Montrose Academy. I was educated in the village school, then briefly in Brechin High School, that being the nearest small town, and then at Montrose Academy, where I took my highs, and then went on to Edinburgh University for a four-year course, honours in English literature. And I then did another year at Mariehouse Training College for teachers. First half of a B.Ed. I only took the Diploma of Education. I then taught for just over a year, I suppose it must have been, until I joined up. I volunteered in February 1940.
Why did you decide to volunteer?
Because I thought that the situation was dangerous, and it seemed to me that one ought to try and turn this into an anti-fascist war and to fight against fascism. And so I left my reserved occupation and volunteered for that purpose. I was at that time a member of the Communist Party, and their line was that one should join the armed forces and become an officer as quickly as possible, which I proceeded to do.
Why was that their line?
I think the line was based on the assumption that at some point there was going to be a revolution in this country and that therefore they would need military cadres in large numbers. And it was therefore good for members to have military training. What they then said was that to let one's membership of the party lapse so that one could, with one hands on one heart, say, I'm not a member of any party.
Well, you would have been asked that, would you, for purposes of becoming an officer?
Conceivably. It didn't actually arise, but it's conceivable that it might have done. You know. And so technically I was not a member of any party.
What had been your personal attitude in September 1939 when the British government declared war?
Well, I had been very much opposed to the appeasement policy. I thought that we ought to have fought over Czechoslovakia, for instance. And therefore I saw after Munich, I thought that war was bound to come in about a year, and thought that it had to be fought, that it was going to be fought under bad leadership, but that one had to join in and try and fight it to a victory of some kind.
What did you consider to be the character of the war as far as the British government was concerned?
I thought that they had their own motives, which weren't necessarily mine. I thought that they were probably there to try and defend the status quo, and I was there to try and change the status quo.
Did you think that the British government were fighting an anti-fascist war?
No, not at all. I thought they were fighting basically for their own interests, because various interests were threatened by the rise of Hitler. And that for reasons of realpolitik, they had decided to use the Polish invasion to declare war on their main imperial opponent.
So how would you have gone about changing it into an anti-fascist war, as you said earlier?
Well, one had only to hope. One had to fight and hope that fascism was destroyed, and that out of the destruction of fascism, some political movement might arise in Europe which would change the face of Europe. So that the thrust, there were a number of people like me in the army at that time, was that the first thing to do is to defeat fascism. And if fascism falls, that will create, we hoped, political opening, which could be then used for changes in society.
Turning now from your own attitude towards the war to that of the people round about you, friends and relatives and so on, how did they greet the declaration of war? Was it similar to August 1914 with enthusiasm, or was it resignation or opposition or what?
With a kind of dismay and acceptance. I think people were deeply shaken by the Chamberlain broadcast on 4th September 1939, but felt that in some way this had been coming for a long time, and therefore it had to be gone through and got over with one way or another. And what was very noticeable, I found, when I joined my unit, which was a Royal Engineer training unit in York, at a cavalry barracks in York, was that a lot of people, we were all volunteers in this unit, but they hadn't volunteered out of any sort of jingoism, but out of a kind of feeling that, well, something's got to be done about this situation. There was very little sort of anti-Bosch, anti-Hun, anti-German feeling. That was not strong at all in my experience in the army. But a kind of feeling, most of them were navvies, long-range, lorry drivers, drivers of steam wagons, things of that sort. They sort of felt that Hitler had pushed us about a bit too much and that we couldn't stand for any more. We had to make a say no at this point. And that was very general amongst them. Amongst my friends, most of my friends were fairly political, and we, I think, saw the war as a war against fascism in a broad sense.
Did you have the choice of joining the engineers?
No, I went along to a recruiting office with my qualifications. And they said, have you got a driving license? So I said, yes. So they said, report tomorrow to the motor transport training unit at York Cavalry Barracks, which I did. And we then had a very short, I think 3 months training course, and then I was posted to the 4th Field Squadron of Royal Engineers, which at that time was in Chatham. And there we were deployed on coastal defence, basically. We were sent up down the Sheppey to defend the Swale Bridge, just at that time a cantilever bridge that joins the island of Sheppey to the mainland. And we sat there for several months. Over Dunkirk, in fact, we saw the troops coming back from Dunkirk. Some of them came into Sheerness, and we saw the trains going past. And we were simply very lucky in the case of my unit that there wasn't an invasion, because we had 5 rounds of ammunition each. And I had fired my rifle 5 times up till then. So we were deployed on anti-parachutist manoeuvres. And we used to just wonder what would happen if it did happen. We also had an armoured car, which was a lorry of some kind with steel plates fixed around it. We used to trundle about and would have been knocked out of it by any anti-tank gun in no time at all. However, from there we then went to Aldershot, to Laffan's Plain, which is a famous place in sapper mythology. There's a sapper song that talks about we're marching on to Laffan's Plain, which is near Farnborough Airport. And we sat there for, I suppose it must have been 2 months, waiting to be sent abroad, re-kitted in tropical uniform.
Sent abroad to?
We didn't know where, but we were given our tropical uniform for overseas service. And then at the beginning of September 1940, we embarked from Liverpool on the SS Orontes, which was an old, I think, P&O liner, and sailed for Egypt. It took a very long time. We went way up, very far north and very far west. I think the German raiders were abroad at the time, and we made a big detour through the North Atlantic. Came in through the Central Atlantic into Sierra Leone in a huge circular detour. From there, we touched in at Cape Town, and from Cape Town, we went up to Suez.
Later on, about this time, you got a commission. Can you tell me how this came about?
Yeah, I applied, following the party line, to become an officer. I applied when we were at Sheppey. I applied for a commission and was interviewed. And amongst the various things I said in my application was that I spoke Russian. And the commanding officer had been military attaché in Moscow. So he asked me 2 questions. One is, what is Pravda, and what is Izvestia? And I was able to answer both these questions satisfactorily, so he said, I think that would be okay. So I sent off and interviewed, and was accepted for OCTU, but since the unit was under embarkation orders, I had to wait until we got to Cairo to go to OCTU.
Can we now make a leap and go on to your capture?
Yeah.
And can you tell me, first of all, whether or not the army had prepared you for the eventuality of being a POW?
Oh, no way at all. Absolutely no way at all. There is an even more peculiar thing about it, which is this, that although I wasn't working directly on Ultra, I worked in the outer office of Ulster, so to speak. I worked in the outer office of Bill Williams, Brigadier Williams, as he then became Montgomery's chief intelligence officer, and a man called Joe Ewart, who was his number two. This was a GHQ in Cairo. And it was quite clear to me that they had access to some source of information which was highly accurate, and that my job in the outer office really was to provide them with scraps of information which could then trigger off certain information that they held. I was never allowed into their office. And it was quite obvious what was happening. And I had, I'd heard the word Ulster. So that, this is jumping ahead a long time, when I came back and eventually rejoined Brigadier Williams, as he then was in Brussels, he said to me, I think I'd like you to work on something rather important, and very secret, and I said, you mean Ultra? He went white. He said, my God, you mean to say you've been a prisoner of war, knew about Ultra? So that this is simply to indicate that there was a certain laxness about people being allowed to go up the front. Anyway, what happened was that I was, as happened to many people who'd worked with Bill Williams in GSQ in Cairo, we were sent up to be staff officers. And I was appointed G3 to 10 Corps, which had just arrived, just been constituted. It had come from Iran and Iraq, basically. It was the mostly Indian units who'd, with ancillary artillery and anti-tank guns, who had been brought down from Iraq and Iran to meet the push towards Alamein. The other interesting thing about the appointment was that it was made clear to us that we were to do two things. One was to, obviously, to report on enemy intentions, enemy intelligence, but also to see and to keep an eye on and to report on how we thought the Corps headquarters was functioning to Bill Williams, who had, I think, set up a kind of intelligence network of his own by which he could judge what was happening in the front. This is a result, I think, really of the disasters of 8th Army under Ritchie and all that terrible period of chaos and confusion. And I had the distinct impression, one of the things I was to do was to say whether the unit was, the Corps headquarters, as far as I could see, it was working efficiently or not. And I didn't get much chance to do that, but I was appointed to 10 Corps, who were stationed, the headquarters was in Matruh, in the hills about, 3 or 4 miles inland from the coast. On the way up, I was rather disturbed by the fact that a lot of transport was coming along the desert road in no obvious semblance of units. I mean, you've got RAF trucks, you've got army, you've got all sorts of things, all mixed up and totally confused, streaming back along the coast road, which didn't augur well, I thought. We got up to 10 Corps, and it was there was no G2. I was G3. There was no G2 on the intelligence side. There was a BGS, a Brigadier General Staff, who seemed to be pretty efficient, but impatient with intelligence, I thought. Sometimes happened. We sat there, and there was a certain amount of fairly confused activity. I think on the second day after I'd been there, I went out to see what was happening and found an armoured car unit on the flank, which was being shelled quite heavily, and they were clearly worried about the movement farther in from the coast, which is coming along the escarpment. Meantime, I interrogated some prisoners. I interrogated prisoners in Mirzmetrou, in the prisoner of war cage, Bersaglieri and some Germans from the 33rd Reconnaissance Unit. Then, I'm not clear now whether it was the first, second or third night, we saw the German signal lights going along the escarpment and then coming down onto the coast, so we knew effectively we were cut off. They came right down, you saw them coming right down, and then they stopped because of the sea. Next day there was quite a lot of shelling. Not much seemed to be happening. There were very curious episodes, such as an attempt, because the telegraph line, telephone line, ran through the camp on poles. Somebody suggested that it might be possible to talk to 8th Army through the telephone, which had not been cut, apparently. And it was a really farcical situation with various Indian Army officers trying to remember enough Urdu to communicate along the telephone line to people at the other end, not managing very well. Eventually, I'm vague on this, but I think it's probably on the third night, where there was orders given to break out. And that was a very curious and uncoordinated occasion. There was one main gap in the perimeter, and people began to form up in very curious mixed columns to go through that. And as we were moving up towards the gap, the big petrol dump in Matruh blew up, like an immense explosion. And the column then went out through the gap and went out several hundred yards and then came under very heavy fire, because what I think had happened was that the Germans had put a ring of tanks around, as it very often did, in a sort of beaters, like grouse beating or deer hunting, around the gap. And they opened fire on the head of the column, which then turned back on itself with 25-pounders swinging around and bashing into jeeps. It all came back on itself like that. I was in a jeep with my driver and a couple of intelligence officers. And we also had the GSI truck with all its maps up in it. And we decided to simply stand on the accelerator and go through as fast as we could. And we got through. We saw these large black objects, big tanks, a lot of tracer. We came through that. And we drove all night, and in the morning, there was a very thick fog, a very mist, which was a very odd thing to find in the desert. And driving along in that, we came face to face with a large Italian lorry filled with bersaglieri. So we leapt out and took them prisoner, about 30 of them, I suppose, about a platoon. So we disarmed them, and I told one of my intelligence officers to get in the truck and to follow us. We lost him, and he, in fact, was hit by a shell, lost a leg shortly after. I don't know who fired or who hit it, but anyway, the truck was hit. And I think the rest of the intelligence officers must have gone with him, because I was then by myself with my driver in my jeep, and we came to a point where we saw two large bodies of MT mixed with guns, field guns, maneuvering, squaring up to each other in a flat piece of desert. And I got out of my jeep and began to look at them with my binoculars, see who was who. And it was very difficult to tell who was who, because the Germans had taken a lot of our transport. It was very difficult to know. When we were doing this, a staff car drove up in a great cloud of dust, and a brigadier jumped out and said, "Who are these?" And I said, "Well, I think that the ones facing our way are the enemy." And he said, "Nonsense, they're facing the wrong direction." So, however, at this point, the Italian eight-wheeler armoured car detached itself from that precise group and came straight at us, firing with everything it had. So he leapt into a staff car and disappeared at a great rate. I jumped onto my jeep and went off fast. We then had a problem, because the whole place was full of scattered groups of what might be enemy or not might be enemy, MT and personnel. So I said to my driver, "I think what we'll do is we'll take the distributor head off the jeep and we'll lie up under some camel thorn until tonight, and then we'll drive on in the dark." So we did that, and we lay there all day, and then at night we got up, and then I discovered that the distributor's head had fallen out of my pocket. So that the jeep, no way of starting the jeep, so I said, "Okay, we now walk." So we struck down the best way probably was to go down along the seashore, and we crossed the coast road, passed through a German convoy, and walked along the beach. We got there in the morning, and we walked all day, and then at night we found ourselves on the Tamta Fuka Airport, which is very heavily bombed when we were there. And a very big sandstorm had blown up, so there were two choices. Either we walked through the airport, which seemed not a good idea, or we took a very long way around the perimeter of the airport, or we walked along the beach and took a chance on that. So in the morning we set off in this thick sandstorm along the beach. When we were some distance along, we suddenly stopped, and there we were amongst a whole bunch of Italian soldiers who were in bathing. So they rounded us up, and I was taken to a... We were in a very bad way. We hadn't eaten or drunk for 2 days by this time. And we were taken to an Italian officer who gave us a great plate of spaghetti and Chianti. And we were then put in a, what was in fact an underground shelter on Fuka Airport, under guard. We were kept there for... We were in fact, when being taken to it, we were in fact machine gunned by a Beaufort fighter bomber. But I got into the shelter safely. We were kept there for a night and a day, I seem to remember. It may have been two nights, I'm not sure. We were then taken by truck from Fuka to Mesmatru, back to Mesmatru, where I was put in the prisoner of war cage where I'd been doing interrogations a few days before, and I found that a bit eerie because one didn't know whether there might not be people still there who had seen me or as prisoners. And we spent a couple of days there, and at that point we were then taken on by transport up over Halfaya Pass to Tobruk and put in an open, big open cage.
What were conditions like in these cages?
Oh, there was simply nothing there. I mean, you got a certain amount of food and water, but that was all. I mean, it was just in the open. You slept. And that was, it's very cold in the desert at night, you probably know, and that was very uncomfortable, sleeping out with no coverage of any kind. But, you know, it was okay, I suppose. When we were in the cage at Tobruk, a very curious and, to me, disturbing thing happened, which was that a small party of Germans came into the cage with an officer who said in English that he was looking for people whom he intended to take to Berlin, and spoke to me and said that he thought I was somebody he would like to take with him. So I then sort of lost myself as quickly as possible. It's probably pure chance, I don't know whether what he was doing or why he was making these suggestions. Fortunately, it was a big cage, so I then lost myself in the mob. And the following day, we were marched down to the harbour, put on a small coasting vessel, and taken along the coast to Benghazi. That took, I think, a day and a night.
Did you see this German take anybody away in his party to go to Berlin?
No, I didn't. It always puzzled me very much, because he didn't seem to do anything about it. It seemed to be a curious... way of going on. It was simply extremely haphazard. On my way down to the harbour, I was interested and frustrated to see on one of the German unit signposts the name of a unit which Bill Williams had been saying some time before, if you see any mention of this unit, let me know. So there it was there, there's no way of telling him. Anyway, we were shipped along to Benghazi and taken, as I remember, straight to Benghazi airport, where we were put on board a plane. There can't have been many of us, about 20, I should think, along with a family of Italian peasants who I think must have been being repatriated from one of the settlements in North Africa. It was one of these very curious wooden Italian transport planes called, I think, a Savoia Macchetti. Anyway, we flew across, and we found this a bit unnerving because it flew extremely slowly and very low, and we hoped that the aircraft in Malta weren't able to come as far across as we were. We landed at Lecce in the heel of Italy, drove through the town, and I remember being immensely impressed by the extraordinary Baroque architecture of the place. We couldn't help being struck by it. And ended up in a tobacco factory, in very curious circumstances, sleeping in straw, in a situation where the tobacco workers could come up to wire and look at us. It's rather like being in a cage, in that sense. And they were very aggressive, and particularly the women, who were extremely aggressive and shouted and were generally insulting to us.
What type of things were they shouting? Could you understand?
Well, I spoke Italian well, but there were mostly obscenities, one kind of sexual obscenities of one kind or another. We didn't stay there long. I think we stayed one night. We were put on trains, and it was a very big train, a very full train, which then went up the coast to Bari. And at Bari, we were unloaded and marched through the streets. And that was unpleasant because the crowd, again, was very hostile. Bari, I think, had been bombed shortly before that. Certainly, there was a lot of hostility from the crowd. We then were put in a camp somewhere on the outskirts of Bari, which was very, very small for the number of people who were there. It was said to have been made for 400, and there were certainly more than 1,000 of us. New Zealanders, all sorts of people. It had one immense advantage. It had an artesian well. There was an unending supply of water, very good water. But the food was extremely scarce. We got, per day, we got one, what the town's called, a panotta, which is like a breakfast roll. And you might get an onion with that and a large anchovy or a tomato. And that was your day's ration, basically. So you had there were two schools of thought. There were those who said the thing to do is to eat your panotta at one go, because that's the only way to be satisfied. And there was the other school which said you cut it up into very thin slices and you eat it across the day, and that keeps you going across the day.
Which school were you in?
I ate it all up. I didn't believe in this slicing technique. The anchovies were extremely salted. They were very good fish, actually, but they'd been kept in barrels of salt, so you had to wash them for ages under the water, under the tap, before you could eat them. And then, curiously, we got a Dixie can lid of wine, which was the Italian soldiers' ration for the day. And that was about it, really. That was about all you had.
Do you think that you were receiving Italian army rations, or worse?
No, I think worse. I think, really, they didn't have enough to go around. It was part of the Italian army ration. But I think they simply, they were overwhelmed with the number of prisoners they had, and it just wasn't there. It was a very bad camp in many ways. The commandant was eventually shot as a war criminal. The stories I've heard it is that after we left, two British officers escaped from the camp, were recaptured, brought back to camp, asked to demonstrate how they'd done it, and were shot as they demonstrated how they got out through the wire. Well, anyway, from Bari.
So, before we move from Bari, could I ask you one or two questions about life in the camp there? How did the prisoners manage to amuse themselves in the time which they had on their hands?
So there was no way to amuse oneself there at all. There was absolutely nothing there. There was nothing. Part of the almost ritual behaviour of prisoners of war is to explain to anybody he can get a hold of how he came to be there and how it was impossible it should be otherwise. Because basically, you see, there were really two moral dilemmas. Theoretically, one should either have been killed or should be back with one's own troops, so that one had to explain how neither of these two things had happened. And so you had this immensely boring and repetitive situation of everybody telling everybody else how it was inescapably necessary that he should be where he now was, and that the other possibilities were to be ruled out entirely.
Did you find yourself doing
this? Oh, absolutely, yes. Everybody does that. It's part of the process. But it's immensely boring after that, particularly you get the second or third time around. So there's an immense... See, I think the experience of being taken prisoner of war is one of very often a physical shock, a physical exhaustion, and an extreme sense of failure, when somehow has failed in some terrible way. in that as one is not either dead or with one's own troops. So that one has to justify this. And I think a lot of the early times of prisoner of war, it lasts quite a long time, is this attempt to deal psychologically with the fact of having been made a prisoner. Trying to explain it, A, to oneself and B, to others. Trying to rationalise it. And find ways of making it acceptable, A, to oneself and B, to others again. So that was a very important process, and that took up most of our time. That combined with making up imaginary menus, because this was, I think, it's quite well known, one of the effects of extreme, a lot being very hungry, is that you think a lot about food. And you had people discussing menus, and